Hey guys, and welcome back to episode 8 of Underrated, a podcast where we look at films we believe are underrated, generally disliked, or simply forgotten. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, and with me is my co-host, James Hamrick. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I am doing better. We're actually recording late this week because I was completely knocked out with a pretty bad cold. And this morning is also rather late. My computer crashed, so I lost my notes. And so I'm kind of winging it today. So if I sound more disjointed and confused than normal, that's why.
Yeah, I'm going to try to not make it a habit of this, but this is the second week in a row where I literally finished watching the movie right before we record. So I have some notes as well, but they're not anything special. So this will probably just play out more like a conversation as opposed to like critical analysis of anything.
And I want to ask you guys real quick, if you enjoy this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes. That really helps people find us. And also give us a like on Facebook. All right, today we will be reviewing The Frighteners. But before we get into that, have you seen any cool movies lately?
I haven't seen any movies this week. I'm planning on going out and seeing, hopefully, The Magnificent Seven, maybe this Sunday.
Okay.
So I'll be able to talk about something next time we record.
Yeah, I actually watched the original and the remake back-to-back, and I don't want to talk about it too much right now because I think we might do a mini-sode on it after you see it, just considering the critical reception to the remake. And I enjoyed both. The original, it's very much of its time, and that includes heroes that basically maintain a single facial feature for the entire film. And that's cool, like when it's Steve McQueen or Yul Brynner, but it does make the quiet moments a little boring. And so I enjoyed it. I didn't hate it, but I think I prefer the new one just because the characters are a lot more consistently engaging throughout, and the action is pretty awesome, but we'll get into that more in the minisode. I also saw Tim Burton's Big Fish, and I really don't have a lot to say about it. It's just, it was fine. Have you seen that film?
I very much love that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I haven't seen it for a long time, though, but yeah, one of the reasons I'm sure is just because I really like Ewan McGregor, but I'm usually not a huge Tim Burton fan. I feel like he kind of goes off into his own world with all of his movies, and he makes the movies that he wants to make, which is, you know, I mean, that's fine, but for me, it's every time he makes a movie, it's this is Tim Burton's version of this world. And for whatever reason, Big Fish felt like it was a little bit more subdued Tim Burton. I mean, even though it was really out there, I guess the visual style of it felt more toned down. And I really liked the oddity of it.
Yeah, for me, it's just, I didn't think it did much with the central concept of, you know, fiction versus reality and legends and myth-making and whatnot. And the characters didn't seem like, act like real people. So I think a film that actually does the concept better is Secondhand Lions, which is a really great little family film. But as far as Big Fish, it was fine. No huge complaints, but it didn't really impress me in any way. I mean, Ewan McGregor is always wonderful to watch, but aside from that, there wasn't much for me. All right, well, let's move into our main review of The Frighteners. The Frighteners was released in 1996. It was directed by Peter Jackson. It had a budget of $26 million, and it only made $29 million back. It's a pretty disappointing film, which does make it pretty surprising that they gave him, $300-400 million to make The Lord of the Rings. Do you know how much the budget was on that?
I'm not sure what it was, but it had to have been something insane just because of the production that went into that movie, or those movies.
Yeah. Yeah, I doubt that would happen these days, but I'm really glad it did.
Yeah.
It stars Michael J. Fox, Trini Alvarado, Jeffrey Combs, Jake Busey, and D. Wallace Stone. This has been kind of a favorite of mine for the last couple of years since I saw it. It was the first non-Lord of the Rings Peter Jackson, or it was the first pre-Lord of the Rings Peter Jackson film I saw. And it really wasn't what I was expecting, considering films like Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and King Kong. I think Jackson has found a way of morphing his style into what mainstream Hollywood audiences want to see. But I think this one is like the perfect blend of his crazy, wacky New Zealand independent flair with kind of a Hollywood narrative. And I think it works really, really well. This is your first time seeing it. What did you think?
Yeah, I actually liked it a lot. The only movie I had seen other than this that was kind of his pre-Lord of the Rings filmmaking style was Brain Dead or Dead Alive. It has two titles.
A quaint little drama.
Yeah, it was, you know, just a really good, like, thinking piece. But, I mean, I enjoyed both. This one is definitely, like, in just in terms of, like, a narrative, this is the better film. But, it was, because I had seen Dead Alive beforehand, like, this didn't totally shock me. But I really like his directing style. Like, before, even though Lord of the Rings is, like, pretty much the greatest thing ever, like, there is something fun to watch the kind of, like, to watch the kind of movies that he made before it.
Yeah, there's a crazy energy in the camera work here that, well, I'm not going to say anything against the camera work in Lord of the Rings or any of his later films. There's just an energy and excitement going on that you don't see later on, and I kind of miss it. I would love to have him direct another $20 million movie or something.
Yeah, it'd be nice for... I'm not entirely sure what he's working on right now, but it'd be nice if, after whatever he's doing, he kind of went back and literally just pulled out his own camera and filmed a nice little New Zealand film.
I find it rather strange that this film is virtually unknown. Like film buffs will know it just because it's by Peter Jackson, but there's not as much of a cult following as I would have expected.
Yeah, I think it's weird that, honestly, like, I think Brain Dead and Bad Taste and, this other one, Meet the Feebles, probably have, like, a bigger following than The Frighteners, which is really weird, considering, as you know, like, wasn't this Michael J. Fox's, like, last big movie before, he had gotten Parkinson's?
Yeah, it's his last leading role, and I think this one really shows what we miss from him later on, because, I mean, everyone knows he's a fantastic comic actor, but he does a lot of great drama in this one, too.
Yeah, that was something I wasn't, like, really expecting. And probably just because almost everything I know about Michael J. Fox comes from Back to the Future. So to see, like, and this is another comedy, so I was, you know, it'll be the same Michael J. Fox that I really like. And even though he was still funny in this, he does get a chance to kind of show off his dramatic range a little bit more so than in most movies that he's in.
Yeah, there are touches of Marty McFly in his performance, but this is definitely a lot deeper role than that one.
So one of the things that I actually really liked about this movie was that it's a dark comedy that is both dark and funny. Because a lot of the times in dark comedies, they'll overplay the dark to the point where it's not even really humorous. And then they'll focus so much on being funny that it's not even really that dark. But this is a movie where it's you know, I mean, it's got an R rating. It's got moments of real, like, really dark moments, specifically in the finale when we keep seeing the flashbacks to the original murders. But even though it gets really dark, like, I still found myself laughing. Like, it did that thing that I think we kind of touched on with Dead Man's Chest, that kind of line that can be pretty tough to balance, where it doesn't feel like a jarring shift when you go from something that's, you know, some pretty dark material straight into, like, almost, like, physical humor.
Yeah, the structure of this film is really intriguing from a tonal perspective, because it starts out as pretty much a straight comedy and it remains that way for about the first act, but then, like, and the second act is, it slowly gets more and more serious and darker and darker. And by the third act, it feels like pretty much a straight comedy. I mean, not a straight comedy, a straight horror film. And I find that really, really interesting. Yeah, I really can't think of another film that kind of breaches genres like this one does. And just the way it does it, it would be jarring if you came from the first act to the third act, but just the way he handles the tone, it flows really naturally from the comedy into the darkness. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it definitely didn't go where I was like anticipating it to go. Like whenever we have like this walking chicken and then the guy's standing in his kitchen with the dishes flying and he's like, I'm sure there's a perfectly natural explanation for all this. Like, it felt very much just like a by the book. Well, not maybe not a by the books, but very much just like a comedy. And then, like you said, as the movie kind of goes on, it gets darker and darker as the story unfolds, and then ends in a, at least with the finale, it ends in a pretty dark place.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it felt pretty natural.
Yeah. And I do think the comedy goes a bit overboard, and like Jackson was just showing off with the special effects with the ghosts in the first, when they first arrive back at the home after the first,
I guess their first con.
Yeah. After the first job. And it just, it's like a whole bunch of comedic sequences right after the other involving the ghosts and what they can do. And some of them are really funny, but some of them feel like they're reaching. But aside from that, I think the comedy works very well. And it is, I think, having a Ghostbuster who is employing the ghosts is a pretty unique and funny concept. And I think Fox, he has a really great repertoire with the ghosts. And did you notice that the Black Ghost, I mean, it feels horrible saying that, but I forgot his name. He's played by Chai McBride, who's the police chief in iRobot.
I knew he looked familiar. I did not know that. Huh.
Yeah, but he's really funny, and so is the other guy. They have a great chemistry together. It was really sad to see them go when they did, the way they did. It was kind of rough, pretty rough.
Yeah, I know. I'd become attached to those characters.
And in case you didn't know, I'm sorry about that, but spoilers. We're going to spoil this movie.
Oh, yeah. I think we've already discussed a lot of the third act by now. But yeah, that's one of the things that I want to talk about was I really like the supporting cast of characters for the most part in this movie. I think both of them were really good. I really liked the sheriff. He was a good character. And was the drill sergeant the same actor from
Full Metal Jacket?
Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah.
That's who I thought. As soon as I heard his voice, I was like, there's no way they got him for this. Even though his character was like not entirely relevant to the plot, other than giving him the guns towards the end, at least it was just funny to see him. It was very unexpected.
Yeah. And I think that's, speaking of the guns, that's the moment where I decided I love this film. When Michael J. Fox jumps up on the car with the two machine guns. It's pretty epic.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. And I do wish, part of me wishes that it was the drill sergeant who jumped up on the car with him. But it was just it was a really fun moment anyways. And I actually liked, I don't think I've seen anything else that she's been in, but I also really liked Trini Alvarado in the lead female role. I thought she had a good chemistry with Michael J. Fox, and their scene where they were eating together and her husband is sitting in the chair and it just kind of flashes forward and she's just asking about his own life. Like, there were a lot of funny moments between the two.
Yeah, Peter Dobson as the deceased husband was pretty hysterical at times. A lot of the situational comedy between Bannister and Linsky and the dead husband is pretty hysterical. I like how he's like so over the top and just a total drama queen. Yeah, but I think like the element of dark comedy he adds to the film works. It glides it into the darker half very smoothly, I think.
Something else that I really liked about the movie was it had really good villains. Like,
oh yeah.
This was a, you know, as the movie goes on, it gets a lot darker. And I think that, what's his name? Jake Busey?
Yeah.
Who, once he showed up on screen for the first time, I paused it and I was like, is that Gary Busey? And so I had to look it up, and evidently they're brothers and they definitely have some family resemblance. But he was suitably crazy and creepy in this movie. And one of my favorite parts in the whole film was whenever Patricia turns out to be like the villain, because I legitimately didn't see that coming. I knew that they were trying to make us think that the mother was part of, like, was one of the villains. I was like, nah, I don't think that's true. And so maybe with that being said, I should have seen it coming. But whenever she comes back down and she says, "Oh, we're gonna wait on Mom. She wants to go," I was like, "There's something, something's going on." But I didn't see it coming that she was working with Bartlett. So that was a nice twist that I didn't see coming.
Yeah, it was a great reveal and very well set up, I think. And Dee Wallace Stone, she plays it really well, I think. Just both sides, as the kind of the helpless, suppressed woman, and then as the completely psychotic psychopath.
Yeah, she, like, for the majority of the movie, she's playing, like, she's playing her character in a very sympathetic way, where you are, even though, like, I wasn't sold on the mother being a villain, I was still I still felt like she had the wrong idea of her daughter, and, like, in my mind, her daughter was innocent. Like, it was like, you know, they're gonna have some sort of twist that she was possessed, or something was going on. And so whenever, you know, she was like, oh, she can't leave the house, and it was essentially just showing that she was forced to be a complete recluse, and almost seemed, you know, she was haunted by this ghost that we see in the first scene, and you couldn't help but, like, feel sorry for her as a character, which kind of added to why when she came down from the stairs and she just seemed totally different, and then you kind of see her talking with the ghost of Bartlett, then all of a sudden, like, the entire way she's portraying this character just completely shifts to where she's no longer sympathetic to, in any way, shape, or form, but is just completely off-the-wall crazy in a really creepy, almost unsettling way. And she plays both of those sides really well.
Yeah. I have a question. Did you watch the director's cut or the theatrical version?
It was the director's cut.
Okay. And I really enjoyed Frank Bannister's character and arc throughout this film, where he starts the film, he's at a really low point, he's like completely pathetic, he's a con man, and he's pretty bad at that actually as well. Yeah, and then as the film progresses, people start dying around him, and he's trying to stop it, and there's this Grim Reaper character who he sees doing it, and then, but through different circumstances, he's implicated. And then when Jeffrey Combs' character shows up, it's actually pretty believable how he convinces Bannister that he might actually be the killer. And also, throughout those scenes, you see there's these really clever flashbacks to that actually reveal why Bannister is the way he is and his rather tragic past. And it's actually pretty heartbreaking. Just the image of the halfway finished house he's living in, and then you see the basketball court turned into a garden, and I may or may not have cried there a little bit, but it's quite sad, actually.
Yeah, it's really, that was another aspect that I really didn't anticipate, the fact that even though it's a dark comedy, I guess to make a dark comedy work, you've got to be invested in these characters, and yeah, the flashbacks really are, like, they add a lot of depth to what could have just been kind of he's just our funny lead character. And something that I wanted to point out, during the third act, whenever he's walking through the hospital and it's kind of going to flashback, and then when he's driving the British woman Magda, he has her in his car and it goes into flashbacks to the original car crash. I couldn't help but think of, like, the scene from Return of the King where Frodo, like, falls on the ground and it instantly switches into, like, a much lighter tone, like, a lighter environment. For whatever reason, like, I was really reminded of that, like, as he's falling against the hospital doors and all of a sudden he just kind of switches into this completely different environment. I mean, it's nothing even substantial to point out, but I just, my mind instantly went there during those scenes.
Yeah, I was going to say that for last, but I'll go into that now. That hospital sequence, that well, basically the entire chase, when you find out that Patricia is one of the killers, that entire chase throughout through the house with the shotgun and then into the hospital is, I think, pretty much perfect from a filmmaking standpoint. The way Jackson integrates just the flashbacks with the reality of what's happening, going back to the to the mass shooting, which it actually it's pretty disturbing. I think I would want to warn anyone, if you haven't seen the film, there are some fairly disturbing elements and images of a mass shooting. I can't go back in time and blame the film for like tapping into our national psyche 20 years later, but there are some pretty disturbing elements to it.
Yeah, it was definitely not something that I was expecting. I mean, I guess all of Jackson's movies pre-Lord of the Rings were all R-rated, so I don't know why I was surprised that this one was. But it, I mean, it definitely earns its R rating. There are some pretty brutal scenes, and you know, when they get brutal, like, most of the time it's played to comedic effect, but there are instances where it's, it gets, some of the violence is pretty dark in its betrayal.
Yeah, but I love how it integrates them. Like, where he'll turn a corner and he's back in the old hospital, and he'll, like, then she'll be there as her younger self aiming the gun at him, and then a flashback, it's really her. And it's just really, it's hard to explain, but it is very creative, very, and actually a very exciting way of portraying a chase scene that I haven't seen, like, since. I it's so unique.
Yeah, I think, like, even without the flashbacks, it's already, like, a pretty well done and intense edge of your seat kind of chase. But that, like, that extra element, really, because it's like exposition, almost, or at least, you know, it's explaining the plot in the middle of a chase scene, and yet it doesn't bog down the chase scene. Like, it's the like opposite; it adds to it. And so it was really creative, just decision making behind the camera to implement it that way, and have it work out the way it did.
Yeah, I mean, I love the rest of the film as well, but that, it's so good, just in the quality of filmmaking on display there, that it almost feels like it's from a different film in a way. But it does fit in. Then Dammers comes and reminds you you're in a comedy.
Yeah, he shows up and he's in true Peter Jackson fashion. He's just muttering all sorts of insane stuff. Parts of his performance really kind of took me back to Braindead. The way some of the more over-the-top characters were portrayed in that movie.
Yeah. And he has such a great introduction. Where he's interrogating Linsky's character. And, like, she yells at him, he freaks out and runs out of the room, and he's, like, peeking around the door. And then just how well-researched she is, how he knows every single tiny detail of the case he's investigating. But then it's slowly revealed that he says, oh, he's not going to be convicted. All my cases end in suicide.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that is such a creepy moment.
Yeah, he's definitely, like, to me, he embodies a lot of, like, of the film, in that he can be a really funny character, and then just turn the corner and, like, all of a sudden he's providing, like, the darkness of the scene. Like, his backstory is pretty tragic. It's really sad. And yet he's still, like, he's the most over-the-top zany part about the movie, almost.
Yeah. I'm wearing a lead breastplate.
That scene, like, that just shouted Jackson. Like, that was his humor. It just kind of came out of nowhere, very in your face, and that was something that something else that I really want to talk about the movie. We talked about it a little bit early on, but you can see there is such a huge contrast in his filmmaking style in all of his movies before Lord of the Rings. And even though this movie definitely felt more mainstream friendly than his previous movies, I think that's only from, like, kind of like what you said, a narrative standpoint. Because just in terms of camera work, this still very much feels like Braindead and Bad Taste.
Yeah.
And that it feels like it's all shot. Like Peter Jackson has his camera in his hand and he's walking around. He's doing it all. There's not really a whole lot of establishing shots or the camera's never really planted firmly in the ground during any of the scenes. And whenever a character is like giving important pieces of dialogue, it seems like his natural instinct is just to like run up to the character and like put the camera right in their face really fast and then just pull back. And there's something about it, like it's kind of a love it or hate it thing. I love it. I could see why some might hate it, but for me, like it's the most natural way I think the camera could work in this kind of movie.
Yeah, the camera is very much a character in this film, I think. Just how it follows them when they're running or moving, or it feels like you're a character in the scene kind of moving around and watching. And I love it. When it's done well, it's really fun. I think Sam Raimi is another director that uses a very similar style in his mainstream films, like Spider-Man films. But it's a really dynamic style. It calls attention to itself, but I think in a good way.
Yeah, it's very distinct. I like it when directors kind of have their own visually distinct way of directing. And, I mean, Jackson's almost replaced it with another form of directing that you can kind of see carried through all of his movies post-Lord of the Rings. But for this, you know, If I were to see this movie without knowing it was Jackson, I would be like, this really reminds me of like early Peter Jackson, because it's just so distinctly him.
Yeah.
One of the last things that I wanted to point out that I really liked about this movie, and you know, this really isn't even a pro in terms of like when it came out, but because it's, I think, 2016, this is how old is this movie?
96 is 20 years.
So yeah. So given that it's a 20-year-old movie, I was born in 95, but I have older siblings. So as I grew up, I was still growing up very much like in the 90s culture. And so it's really fun for me to go back and watch like 90s films and just get the nostalgia, because this was very much like a product of the 90s. Just incredibly cheesy, but still really fun. And you kind of see a little bit, even though, like we said, Jackson has his own distinct filmmaking style, you can kind of see that it's moving more towards the cinematic direction of movies that we have now. But it was just a lot of fun. Like, I love going back and watching like old 90s films that are so unapologetically a product of their time.
Yeah, and also very much a product of the particular artist working on them.
Yeah, like 90s Peter Jackson is just so much fun. It's such a fun, and I would recommend, obviously, everybody watch this movie and then all of his other movies. Like, they're all incredibly gruesome and gory, and you can definitely see that Jackson just loves filming that kind of stuff.
Yeah, one more thing I really want to praise is I really like how Jackson stages some of these chase sequences. They're really broad and sprawling, covering a lot of ground, but they're always really coherent and exciting. Especially the prison scene where the Grim Reaper has come to kill Linsky, and he can't protect her because whenever he tries to attack the ghost, he just goes right through it. And so you have his two ghost friends, they're wrestling with the ghost and is passing through the walls. And they're stuck in a cell trying not to die. And then when he finally escapes and they're trying to run and Dammers is trying to catch them, kill him. But it's a really creative way to shoot an action scene where you have characters that aren't bound by walls and then other characters who can't see them. Only one character can see the threat, but he's trying to kill the character who can't see it. And then there's another character who doesn't believe any of it, who's trying to kill one of them too. It's crazy. It sounds confusing, but it works really well.
Yeah, it's got like a lot of moving parts. It's a really dynamic kind of chase scene. Like you said, like because he knew so much about, like, he knew what was going on, he really was able to film it in a way that, the audience doesn't feel like they're trying to keep up with the action. Like, it's being presented in a very clear way. And like you said, just a really exciting way.
There's so many moving parts and different alternating fronts, but it's never confusing. And also, there's just a lot of humorous touches, like when like how Dammer screams when she douses her with the fire extinguisher, and when Bannister runs over and kicks him, how his gun just flies up in the air and he catches it. There's just an element of just fun to it all. It's just an exciting, dynamic, and fun way how the way the film moves through the action scenes.
Yeah, everybody's acting in like kind of an exaggerated real. It's almost the way like action scenes would kind of work in the more zany, almost 1960s Batman-esque, where you kick somebody and whatever they're holding just flies into the air. And it doesn't feel out of place. Like, even though like this movie has some touches of like really dark realism in some of the shootings, it, even though like those two kind of scenes stand in such stark contrast, like when looked at together directly, just within the flow of the movie, it feels really natural. And it, whenever this movie is trying to be fun, like in this scene, it really is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and Dammers is such an interesting character, where he thinks he's the hero. He thinks he's stopping this vicious psychopath who's trying to justify his murders through whatever kind of psychotic tricks and psychological excuses. And he goes on this really, he has several really great monologues as he's about to try to kill Bannister, just explaining what he thinks about him. And I think Dammers is a bit of a psychopath, but he does think he's the hero. I think his death scene is pretty epic.
Yeah.
And I think the setups and payoffs in those scenes like that, where there's these reveals like that, such as when in scenes where it looks like there's no hope, but then something comes in to save them, that you, it's not like a Deus Ex Machina, because you already know it's there, but you just forgot about it, such as like when they're in the cell and his two ghost buddies come and help them, or when they're in the car in the graveyard and the Reaper's about to kill Linsky, and then Fox jumps up with the machine guns. Just how Jackson builds the scenes is really exciting, I think. You really feel each and every payoff. It's not easy to do. It sounds simple, but how Jackson sets up those scenes, and basically with every, you're on the edge of your seat through every escalating threat, and when the payoffs come, every single one of them works.
Like you said, like that wasn't even really something I noticed until you're bringing it up now. Like, it's not a, and then this shows up and saves the day. Because I mean, Jackson is no stranger to Deus Ex Machinas, given he has several movies which feature the same one.
But he sets it up and earns it, I think.
Yeah, and like you said, what I guess could have just been a throwaway character, because ultimately his purpose was just to give him the guns in that action scene, but what seemed like just a throwaway character with the drill sergeant ends up, you know, playing an important role in one of the climactic scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, he even undermines scenes like that. Like when he finally defeats the Reaper, and he gets out the Sith, and it's like a really exciting moment. He's gonna kill him, and then there's the shock. And first, you don't know what it is, because it almost feels like he hits a force field, and then he goes back to his real body. And I really like how Fox plays as he's half dead and frozen. Like, I don't know what it feels like to be frozen, but I think it would be a lot like how he plays it.
Yeah, like almost letting out like this little whimper. Like, it was kind of funny.
Yeah, I'm sorry my praises are so scattershot. It's just I lost all my notes immediately before recording, so just bear with us. Yeah, now, speaking of the action scenes, there was the one scene where you have, in the graveyard, you have Dammers and Linsky grappling while the Reaper is trying to kill Linsky, and Fox, as a ghost, is trying to stop the Reaper. And like the scene in the prison, you think it would be confusing, but it works really well.
Yeah, I think it's essentially the same positive, just in that, like, there is so much going on in the action scene, but it's being it's being filmed by someone who, like, I think at this point in his career, he was almost deceptive in the way, like, you look at his films initially and you think, oh, this is just somebody who likes to, like, a bunch of gore and weird humor. But you can see that, as, you know, as kind of different and odd as his early movies are, you can see, like, a genuine craftsmanship under him.
No, I like how he uses characters. It reminds me a bit of how, like, J.J. Abrams, like, people criticize, say he's all style no substance, but how he shoots action scenes, he always comes in for a reaction to the character's face. Like, whenever anything happens, the camera immediately goes to the character's face, and it adds a level of humanity into these action scenes that is often forgotten. I think Jackson does this really well. Just throughout, you feel the pain when a character is injured. You feel their terror. You feel the humor, because all of it always comes back to the characters. And I think it's a really solid way of directing that is often forgotten in these big blockbusters.
Yeah, I've poured through the hours upon hours of bonus features across all of his Middle Earth movies, and that's something that you can tell that he cares a lot about. He was in the storyboards. He was, like, explicitly telling the other people who were working on the film that in order to kind of avoid battle fatigue or in order to ground action set pieces, that I think he really didn't want any more than, you know, a certain amount. I can't remember the number, but he really didn't want more than a certain amount of shots before we would cut back to a key character, because at a certain point it's like, okay, now he's just throwing stuff at the screen. But as if you keep going back to the reactions of these characters, it makes it feel less like it's just eye candy and more like, oh no, this is serving a purpose, because now we got the reaction shot. We got to see what our lead characters are, what they're reacting to, and the way that what's seemingly just, you know, fun stuff on the screen, like what it's doing to them. I don't know. It's like you said, it's a really good way to keep scenes that can get pretty over the top kind of grounded, at least make them have a sense of place in the story.
Yeah, and a lot of Jackson's films have very long extended climaxes, but he does always ground it into the characters. And I think that's how you sustain a believable level of threat, is you put us in these characters' faces, right in the characters' shoes. And I think he does that very well in this film and even his later films. All right, I think I might have to think of some more positives later on, but let's move into our dislikes. What were some dislikes you had?
So, this one feels maybe a little weird, considering I actually had, like, several good things to say about what the character brought. But I feel as if, in some sequences, Danners was almost unnecessary. Like you said, the final chase scene throughout the hospital, I think that was pretty much, like, I would agree with you in that it's essentially, like, perfect. There's not really any complaints until, for me at least, until he shows up. Because I feel like just having it be a game of cat and mouse between him and Patricia was really, like, at that, like, they had, it lost most of the humor, and I think that was kind of suitable for the scene. And then when he showed back up, I kind of understand his motivation, that he looks at Bannister as a psychopath that has to die, but he shows up with an Uzi out of nowhere. It kind of, like, even though it was still very Peter Jackson-esque, it felt like it was kind of unnecessary for the scene. And even though I really loved his death, I still feel as if the scene would have been better suited maybe without him in it, or at least having just him show up at the very end right there.
I sort of agree, but as a foil for Fox's character, I don't think he could have been done any better. I kind of agree he could have possibly been written out and the film wouldn't be much different, but in the kind of film this is and how random and zany it is, I love how his character is used. And also, I think he does actually bring a good amount of dramatic heft into Bannister's character. he definitely brings him to his lowest point, where you believe that he would be willing to kill himself to save Linsky.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he does have a lot of, his character does serve a lot of purpose, even from a dramatic standpoint. I think maybe Patricia's character would be just too psychotic as a villain. I think he adds, as an antagonist, he adds a lot to the film. And, dude, he gives us one of the greatest lines in film history, which involving the Uzi. I'm not going to quote it because it's a family-friendly podcast, but it's hysterical.
Yeah, that I definitely may or may not have laughed out loud at that part. But I feel like his backstory, for whatever reason, even though, I mean, as random as this movie is, I feel like you could almost throw whatever you wanted to in it, and being like as random as it is, it wouldn't really feel out of place. But having him, I mean, I know they kind of use it as an explanation for why he's the way he is. Like, I loved his introduction where he keeps peeking around the corner. Like, that was probably some of the funniest moments in the movie for me. But then to, like, at the end, whenever he opens up his shirt and he's got, like, all of these scars and, like, ritualistic markings, it kind of came out of nowhere, and it was really, really dark. And he was, like, almost playing it for comedy because of how over the top he is. And so the comedy there didn't really quite work for me. But, I mean, it's not even a huge complaint. But I just felt like maybe they could have done it, like, his explanation in a different way. Either just, like, have it be, like, funny or tragic. But they kind of tried, like, it seemed like they almost tried to blend the two. Like,
yeah, it does, I think. That scene where he reveals his backstory does feel kind of random and tacked on, but I love how Combs plays it. It turns his character, it makes his character actually fairly tragic. And it is interesting, but I agree, it does feel a little tacked on. And one of the criticisms I had, I mentioned this earlier, but some of the comedic elements in the first act And a little bit in the second act just feel over the top and not in a good way. Just like they belong in a slightly different film. Just maybe a bit too slapstick or a bit too random and just kind of there to be there rather than actually part of the narrative. And there are some really weird, like, ghost sexual elements involving knives and mummies that the less said the better, but I have no idea what they're doing there.
Yeah, that's actually what I have here as well. It was, I mean, the movie itself is not family friendly. There's a lot of gore, and I wouldn't take out the gore because, I mean, it's just so quintessential to Jackson. But to me, it did feel really weird whenever the sheriff jumped into the mummy casket. Like, it was, I don't know, it. I mean, most of the humor in it is very juvenile, but it's still funny. But yeah, that really weird kind of almost, there's only like three times where I even notice it, but for whatever reason, like, the movie jokes in a very sexual way, and it just kind of feels at odds with the kind of humor that's in the other, like, the majority of the movie.
Yeah.
And then that felt very out of character for the sheriff, just as a side note. He shows up and saves the day, and I love that moment because he's a likable character, and then that happens, and I'm like, that. I mean, it's not even like, if it were really, really funny, I would understand just throwing in a random moment. Just, I mean, because it's a comedy, but it wasn't even a moment that I really found particularly funny.
Yeah, it was just bizarre.
And so, bizarre. Yeah, it is really weird. So, another, not on the same subject of in terms of the ghost, but kind of humor that is almost off and on. To me, I cannot remember his name, but Lucy's husband, sometimes he, like, provides some legitimate laughs that I, like, his character can be really funny. And then other times, I don't, it almost seems really forced. Like
after he's a ghost?
Yeah, like, sometimes, like, I like over-the-top performances, like, when it's suitable, and almost 99% of the time in this movie it is, like, every character has had some moment of being completely over the top. But it just seems like, even in regular lines, like, whenever she says, you know, that's very typical of my husband to just take the money and run, and his instant response, like you said, it's a family-friendly podcast, I won't say it out loud, but it seems most of his lines, even when it's just kind of giving regular dialogue, he seems to be shouting most of it. And so whenever like it's played for comedy, like that works, whenever he shouts a line, sometimes it's funny. But then sometimes where he's just having a conversation with Bannister, it's like, oh, all right, we kind of get it. I don't know. Maybe that was just me, but it just seems like he was always like in the same kind of mode. And so whenever like he's having dishes thrown around, it's understandable. But and then when, you know, whenever he first finds out he's a ghost, it's understandable. But then like it just like that whole moment of being over the top never ends, and it's just a constant, like from the moment we're introduced to the character and like his fence is hit to the moment we last see him, it seems like he's always kind of in this over the top mode.
Yeah, I agree his character is a bit overused, but I love that dinner scene, just how awkward it is with the ghost that only Fox can see. And then a conversation with the widow, and it's really funny. And then where it turns into the conversation about the money, I thought it was pretty hilarious.
Oh, yeah, for the most, like, that is actually one of the scenes that I remember most. It had some really funny lines of dialogue. So my complaint isn't so much with the scene itself, just with, I don't know, some of his lines I feel like just could have been delivered in almost a more nuanced kind of comedic way, as opposed to just shouting.
Yeah, no. Another, not exactly a dislike, but kind of the relationship between Bannister and Linsky's character, it feels a bit rushed. It's a similar complaint I had with iRobot, is I just don't think enough time is devoted to establishing a friendship to make this kind of close relationship they have for the last half of the film completely believable. I understand Bannister's character is incredibly lonely and pathetic as a character, and I understand why he would definitely go for it, but Linsky is a very recent widow. I don't know, it just seemed bizarre that she would go for Bannister that quickly.
Yeah, to me it felt like, you know, he's the obvious lead protagonist, or lead male protagonist, and she's the lead female protagonist, so it felt like the scriptwriters just, you know, in their mind, like, well, naturally we've got to find some way to get these two together. Like, I don't even, like you said with iRobot, it feels somewhat unnatural. There's no real reason it has to happen. I mean, we're rooting for a happy ending for the two. And even if that was something that they wanted to do, I feel like there was a more natural way. Like, yeah, he risked his life and he did save her, so I understand that, you know, she would be, you know, she would look at him in a very positive light. But to just kind of leave the climax of the film and go straight into them, like, with their romantic picnic, it felt a little unearned, I think.
Well, yeah, but I think even before that, like, where she keeps returning to him for advice or like, when he's arrested, she shows up to visit him. It's just, it feels like they're a bit closer than they should be and not entirely earned. I mean, I think Alvarado and Fox have great chemistry, and so it plays out well. But I think if they had just given it even just a few more weeks of kind of more of a casual friendship, it would have been a bit more believable.
Yeah, because I think at the prison scene, the last time she had seen him was just whenever he did the, well, no, he did the exorcism, and then she saw him at the funeral, and then the date. But when she's at the prison and she's like, you didn't do the, she's very much arguing in his defense. It did feel a little weird in that he hadn't really at that point in the film done anything to prove himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the fact that they're already, like, you know, a pair that are defending each other and like feel like it's them two against everybody else and no one's believing, it felt kind of like unnatural. And then So I can kind of combine my last two dislikes together because they're somewhat related. We talked about how, like, for the most part, I do think that the shifts in tone feel natural, but there is it. I can't even remember the point specifically, but it does feel like there's a specific moment where it goes from a comedy into like a much darker movie. And both the beginning and the end of the movie, like, if you look at where the movie starts and then you just look at the climax, like, they feel, like, tonally are just so different that even though it was a little, like, it was gradual enough to where it's, like, it's not a huge complaint, it does feel a little weird, like, a little off that it just goes from, like, a direct comedy into, like, with some darker elements into, like, a straight horror movie.
Is that moment when the sheriff gets chopped in half?
It might be that moment.
Yeah. I definitely noticed that as well. I think the transition is slow and steady enough to where I buy it as I'm watching it. Yeah, in retrospect, it is a pretty huge shift. But I think, I don't know how he does it, but I think he handles the tone so deftly that you don't notice it while watching.
Yeah, and so after it kind of shifts in tone, even though, like it, it does feel earned, like, I love Jackson, I love the way he does it, but it feels like, it almost feels as if it shifts into the climax, and then that wasn't really the climax, and so we get almost a second one, and so my
which scene are you referring to?
Whenever he has his out-of-body experience, and he goes to fight the Reaper, and that almost starts feeling like the movie's winding down, like, this is the climax, and then, you know, he doesn't get him, which I thought was, like, a clever moment where, you know, you think it's about to end, but then he gets pulled out, like, just before he can kill him. I'll kill the ghost, which I'm not sure how that works. But, and then it goes into, like, then she leaves, and she goes to the mansion, and then he comes after her, and then they go into the hospital. It's, you know, his movies are usually, like, at least his more recent ones, are 3 hours plus, like, every time. And this is, the director's cut is only 2 hours, so it's weird that I wouldn't have a problem with those and I would with this, but I think it feels a little bit long for the kind of movie it is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think all of his movies, besides maybe Lovely Bones, all have pretty extended climaxes. I think that's something he really likes, and when well executed, I love them as well. I like when a film earns its... I like films that, like, drag their characters through the mud and beat them up. I like that. But I do agree, it does feel a little long. But I love everything in the film, so I'm not going to criticize it too much, but I do agree. My last complaint is sort of a minor nitpick, but also sort of a major gripe, is when Bannister is killed and his ghost appears, which is actually a pretty awesome moment. Like, you completely forget about the ghost, and then his ghost comes out and grabs Patricia's. It's kind of a fist pump moment. But then once he goes to heaven, and they say, well, apparently the authorities say it's not your time yet, and then he comes back to life on Earth. I mean, it feels kind of unearned. Such an easy way to get around that would have been to have Linsky's character performing CPR on Bannister. I mean, that, since they've already established you can resuscitate someone even after they're a ghost, it would make perfect sense because he was choked. So if she, like, was performing CPR or something on him, then it would kind of make sense that he came back to life. But just kind of having him come back to life feels kind of cheap and unearned.
Yeah, I actually had a, like, now that you mentioned, there were a couple things that I had small issues with in that scene. And that was one of them. I thought, you know, like, they're not really going to explain it. They're just going to say, oh, it's not your time. Well, that seemed weird. Like, how often in that movie's universe does that happen where it's like, no, this person, like, by all means should have died, but was determined to not be their time. And so it felt weird.
Well, actually, I mean, I wouldn't mind that. As I said, if she actually resuscitated him, like he was talking there and all of a sudden like he started choking in heaven and then appeared back on Earth, I actually think that would have been actually pretty cool. But I just don't think it's earned the way it is in the film.
Yeah, and I would agree. It just seemed like a almost an arbitrary decision that this was a good guy, so I'll just send him back to live. Like, is that just like a common occurrence in that universe?
Probably not.
But then, so a couple other things that I just had to say about that final scene was the movie hadn't really established what all could be done by the ghost. And so just to see him like grab someone's soul out of her body and like take it up to, up to heaven. The idea that is something that you could do just kind of came out of nowhere. And then as they were going back down, they're saying, we got some more killing to do. And then it ends up that they're going to hell. That also felt kind of weird, where it was like, did the portal just like transform on the way up?
I guess once you enter the portal, there's no going back unless you're Bannister.
Yeah, it just it felt like the movie was doing things that we like that hadn't been established could be done before.
Yeah, and this is sort of a praise. I think the reason that is frustrating is because up till then, I think the film did a really great job of establishing the world and establishing the rules throughout, even like both visually and verbally. We have a pretty good grasp of how this world works. So when something like that happens without much setup, it is pretty jarring.
Yeah, and I think that was really what it comes down to. It just felt very jarring to see. I mean, like you said, even from the beginning scene, as one of the ghosts is struggling to like phase through the door and he needs help, like this world, like the way this world handles ghosts, obviously like, they have their own different kind of rules. And so then just to see like Bannister snatch her soul out of her body, go up to heaven and like send her to it. It felt almost at odds with the way everything seemed to work beforehand.
Yeah. All right. Do you have any more dislikes?
No, for the most, I mean, I really like this movie, so there's not a whole lot of things other than what we mentioned that I didn't like.
Okay. Oh, one last thing. Did you spot the Peter Jackson cameo?
Yes, I did. And I completely forgot that he's a director that puts himself in all of his movies. So whenever he bumps into this gothic person, then I see Peter Jackson like with a lip ring and a nose ring. And it was, as someone who's just a huge fan of Peter Jackson, it was really funny to see.
Yeah. And also, fun fact, the judge or the sheriff guy, he's played by John Astin, who is Sean Astin's father.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I did not know that. I remember seeing, whenever I was watching the movie, I saw the in the credits John Astin, and my mind read it as Sean Astin. So that's really funny that I ended up thinking it was the person I was thinking of was actually his father.
So what are your final thoughts on this film?
My final thoughts for this film is almost essentially the same that I have for like all of his other movies pre-Lord of the Rings that I have, where they're well made, and I think deceptively so, because they feel like just kind of dumb movies. With, just dumb, fun movies. But he knows his way with the camera, and he does a lot of, like, really good setup and payoffs. And it is fun. Like, it's a really fun movie to watch. It's got some really funny moments. Like, you can kind of see Jackson going over the top, which he kind of does in some of his later movies as well. But for the most part, like, if you can handle, like, gore, there's really no reason to not go back and watch this.
Yeah, this movie definitely isn't for everybody, but I think it deserves a lot more attention than it gets. It's such a clever and unique movie. I mean, we very rarely see films that are just this wacky and fun. I think there are a couple foreign directors who do stuff like this. I think Edgar Wright is one of the few mainstream directors who kind of will completely let loose like this, with this level of kind of wackiness and creativity. But yeah, I think it's just a really fun, unique movie with a lot of great humor, some really great acting from Alvarado and Fox and Combs, and just as you said, it's fun, and it also is scary at times, and I think it blends the two pretty well, and I think this movie is worth watching just for that last act alone. The hospital chase sequence, I think, is like a mini masterpiece in itself, where you have the four different characters chasing each other and the flashbacks mixed in, is pretty incredible. And so I'm not entirely sure why this film is forgotten the way it is, but I think it deserves a lot more attention. And personally, I prefer this a bit more than, say, films like Bad Taste. I think he toned down his style just enough while also introducing enough of a dramatic side that was completely absent from Bad Taste, that I think this film is like the perfect encapsulation of who Peter Jackson is as a director.
Yeah, and if anything else, it's, like we said, it's Michael J. Fox's last leading performance. Like, that's... He defined, an entire time period of movies. You know, he was like the go-to guy for a little bit. So for something to be his last, kind of film like that, I think that makes it, worth watching just for that alone.
Yeah, and one last thing before we wrap up. I put up a post on Facebook asking people's thoughts on the movie, and Jeremy Calcara said, I think that's how he pronounces his name. He said, "I love The Frighteners. Michael J. Fox is great, and the story is just a lot of fun." And I think, as you see, we pretty much agree with that.
Yeah, that seems to be, from what I've looked up about it, just trying to gauge what the reaction was to it, that seems to be a common occurrence among people who like it. It's just, it's a lot of fun, so it's absolutely worth going, at least going and running it.
All right, I think we've pretty thoroughly covered this movie. Again, I apologize, it was so scattershot. I lost all of my notes, just as we were about to start, so... So yeah, I hope you enjoyed our review of The Frighteners, and again, if you would please rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe. And if you would like to follow the podcast on Facebook, we are Underrated Podcast. Give us a like there. I am also on Facebook as Gabriel Green. Feel free to shoot me a friend request.
And then if you want to email us, we are theunderratedpodcast@gmail.com. We love reading emails from people who like our podcast, or maybe even don't like our podcast. And then if you want to follow us on Twitter, we are underrated_pod.
All right, next week is your pick, James. So what are we looking at next week?
Next week, we are going to watch the most recent film from my personal favorite director, Interstellar.
Awesome.
Yeah, I am really excited to talk about this movie because I think in a lot of ways, I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, I only saw it once in theaters, and I think right now it might be my least favorite Nolan film, which, I mean, I think half of his films are unqualified masterpieces, so that doesn't necessarily mean much. I remember loving the first three quarters and like being completely flummoxed by the last half. So I have been meaning to rewatch it, so this will be fun to talk about.
We hope you enjoyed our review of The Frighteners, and we definitely hope you go and check it out if you haven't. It's definitely worth it. So we will see you next week with Interstellar.
See ya.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage. Rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end, no dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning they. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.